I can't really fight right now, so Clary helped me up here so we could see as much of the battlefield as possible, since the paths are so irregular and confusing. But then, we noticed that the demons had the same problem we did. They could really only get to us on a set number of paths, and three people could cover two paths each. Magnus raised his eyebrows. So Simon, Tien, and Clary went down there to do that. We put Isabel on the middle platform because she's the only one whose weapon has any reach, so she can handle the occasional flying dude. Alex seemed near tears. I'm very proud of you, he said to Jace. You actually made a plan. I'm good at plans, Jace said. You are actually good at plans, Magnus said. It's just usually you're yelling them behind you as you sprint toward danger. But you used your sumptuous brain and you're all okay, Alex said, thumping Jace on the shoulder. He looked over at Ragnar. Take that, pessimism guy. Ragnar furrowed his brow.
Well, obviously, I'm glad everyone is still alive.
I should mention, said Jace, the ground started shaking a little while ago.
That would be Xinyan, said Magnus. It's a long story. Also, luckily for you, I brought the world's leading expert in dimensional magic, and he's going to portal us right on out of here.
Ragnar gave Magnus a sour look.
I suppose I am, but I'm going to need your help.
Great news, said Magnus, and he jumped off the platform.
He floated slowly down to the plane, waving at Isabel as he passed. Magnus, said Clary, lopping the head off one of the bygudging skeletons. Good to see you.
I'm going to say something, Simon said in Clary's direction, and I don't want you to get mad.
Clary let out a long, beleaguered breath.
Go ahead, I guess you've earned it.
Magnus, Simon said with a smirk. Nice of you to drop in.
Clary sighed again.
I've got good news and bad news, said Magnus. The good news is I'm here to portal us back to Earth. The bad news is that I need Ragnar's help. And he's taking the stairs all the way down.
Ragnar, indeed, was strolling down the staircase at a leisurely pace. As Magnus watched, Jace overtook him, which was impressive given that he was walking with a crutch. The demon horde was beginning to flag, it seemed. New demons appeared from the portals less and less frequently, and both Jace and Isabel joined their friends to mop up what remained. Perhaps the demons had noticed DU's imminent collapse and fled for their lives. Perhaps once Samael and Xinyan were gone, they had no reason to obey their orders. Eventually, Ragnar deigned to join them. He and Magnus quickly worked together to set up a portal. It occurred to Magnus how very much he'd missed working with Ragnar. And when the portal opened, he was relieved to see it glow a familiar, cheering blue. Chapter 20. The Soul of the Clave. In 1910, Katerina Loss's son Ephraim died. By that time, he was an old man with children and grandchildren of his own. Katerina hadn't seen him for decades. He believed that she'd died when he was only in his 30s. In a shipwreck. Magnus had been living in New York at the time, in a smart apartment in Manhattan across the street from the old Metropolitan Opera House, the one they tore down in 1967. A telegram came. Number 2, the Bund, Shanghai, it said, in Katerina's hurried hand. So Magnus fetched his gloves and his hat, and he went. Number 2, the Bund, turned out to be the home of the Shanghai Club. A little bit of English elitism dropped right in the heart of China in the form of a squat marble Baroque revival building in which Shanghai's British elite hobnobbed, drank, and for a short time, essentially ruled the mundane world. The building was new, though the club was not. It was a funny choice for Katerina. She knew as well as Magnus that it was open to white men only. This was Katerina being mischievous in her way. She sometimes enjoyed glamoring herself into the private spaces of rich mundanes, delighting in her ability to stand totally outside their world, to have a drink with an old friend in the face of those who wouldn't allow them entrance under normal circumstances. The whole place was palatial in a way that was also a bit grotesque. Magnus walked through a cavernous columned grand hall, past taipans and diplomats utterly pleased with themselves. They were living like royalty at the heart of one of the oldest kingdoms in the world. They had no reason to think it would ever end, and at the time, Magnus wondered himself how long it could last. Not much longer, it turned out. But for now, here were expensive cigars and brandy, fresh newspapers, and a library rumored to be larger than the city of Shanghai's. Magnus was unsurprised to find Katerina in it. Though no one but Magnus could see her, she was elegantly put together as always. Her dress was a slender column of white satin with a black lace overlay and butterfly sleeves. A black velvet sash waistband completed the affair. Magnus thought he saw the hand of Paul Poiret, the famous designer, at work. Magnus wondered if Katerina had managed to outdress him. She was seated in one of the club chairs, gazing at the shelves across from her as though she were studying their spines from a distance, though they were too far for Magnus to read. He sat down in the chair opposite Katerina and said, "So what's the plan? Are we tearing this whole place down in the name of freedom and equality?" Katerina looked up at him. There were dark circles beneath her eyes. "I had to watch a man die here once," she said. Magnus leaned forward sharply. "What?" "It was a few years ago," she said. "I was here, in the library, and a man fell to the ground, writhing in pain. A medic was called. The other club members gathered around their mate, but none of them had any medical training or knew what to do. They argued about whether to elevate his legs or elevate his head, whether they should be prone or supine. And he died there, before any doctor or nurse could reach him." She looked distant. "Could I have saved him, magically or otherwise? Could the mundane doctors, if there had been one here? I don't know. Maybe he would have died regardless, but what could I do? I couldn't simply appear to them as if from a dream. They'd think somebody had poisoned the punch." "Do they still serve the punch?" said Magnus. Katerina raised an eyebrow. "You think I am being morbid?" "I think," said Magnus, "that the fact that mundanes die and we can't save them isn't something you just recently learned." Katerina sighed. "It's not that we can't save them," she said. "It's that we can't save them even if we love them. Very, very much." There were tears in her eyes now. He knew better than to say anything. Instead, he simply took her hands in his. After a moment, she said, "For mundanes, it is considered the greatest of tragedies if a parent outlives their child. For Vorlach parents, it is an inevitability. I always thought it was strange that most Vorlachs spend their lives alone, without attachments, without ever putting down roots." Magnus let her trail off and said gently, "If you had to do it over again, would you choose not to do it?" "No," Katerina said without hesitation. "Of course I would do it again. No matter how many times I was made to choose, I would choose to adopt and raise Ephraim again, to see him become a man, to have children and grandchildren of his own, however hard it was, however hard it is now." "I've never had a child," said Magnus, "but I know what it is to lose someone you love, for no better reason than that all humans must die." "And," said Katerina. "So far," said Magnus, "life seems to be a matter of choosing love over and over, even knowing that it makes you vulnerable, that it might hurt you later, or even sooner. You just have no choice.
You choose to love or you choose to live in an empty world with no one there but you. And that seems like a truly terrible way to spend eternity. Katerina didn't quite smile, but her eyes glistened.
Do you think vampires go through this kind of thing too?
Magnus rolled his eyes. Of course they do. I've found you can't get them to shut up about the topic for even a moment.
Thank you for coming, Magnus.
I would always come, he said. Katerina wiped her eyes with her hand.
You know, she said, sniffling a bit, this club contains the longest bar in the world downstairs.
The longest bar? Said Magnus.
Yes, she said. It's at least 100 feet long.
It's called the Long Bar. The English are good at luxury, Magnus said. But they don't always make creative naming decisions, do they?
You'll see, said Katerina. It's very long.
Lead the way, dear lady. As they tumbled forth from the portal, Alec at first was sure that portals were still malfunctioning. He expected the busy streets of Shanghai, but they seemed to have ended up in a patch of trees, towering and narrow and densely planted, their leaves beginning to change from pale green to yellow to orange. Nearby, Alec could see the moon reflected on water. It was dark, which surprised him, but he wasn't quite sure how many hours they had spent in DU, and knowing how bizarre dimensional travel could be, there was probably some time dilation effect. He could probably ask Ragnar.
Where have we ended up? Alec called out. Are we close to Shanghai?
He turned to see Jace raise his eyebrows at him in surprise. Wordlessly, Jace gestured to the view behind him. Alec took a few steps and, through the trees, very suddenly, were the lights of Shanghai, sparkling in every color.
Oh,
he said.
There are these things called parks, said Jace. It's been a long couple of days, said Alec.
People's park, said Tien.
He gestured to the water Alec had noticed before, which he now could see was a small pond with banks of carefully arranged stones. Lilies floated, black against the glassy surface.
That's the 100-flower pond there. A good choice, he added to Ragnar and Magnus.
Ragnar nodded in acknowledgement.
I thought it would be quiet this time of night.
What time is it? Said Clary.
After a moment of peering at the sky, Magnus said,
It's about 10:30.
You can tell the time from the sky? Said Alec, amused.
Magnus looked surprised.
You can't?
Hey, guys, said Simon. Can we take a moment to just quickly celebrate that we won and nobody died? Because I don't think we should just let that go without mentioning it.
Hear, hear, said Isabel, punching the air in victory. Hooray for us! We beat a prince of hell!
Well, said Ragnar, to be fair, you all saved Magnus and me from the Sveffenthorn. Alec, specifically, obviously. And then Xin Yun went mad and began wrecking DU. So the prince of hell left to find a different realm. And he'll definitely be back at some point. Xin Yun also is a loose end, as she is now some kind of dragonfly spider thing.
Everyone paused to soberly consider that for a moment. Finally, Simon said,
But everyone lived. Magnus saved you, and Alec saved Magnus, and my girlfriend saved me while riding on a giant tiger.
Yes, acknowledged Ragnar. The day has not been a complete loss.
Alec smiled, but he was tired of being away, and he felt a pull toward home, one that he wasn't used to, but that now beckoned him with an incredible force. Max. Max. He tried to catch Magnus's eye, but Magnus had come up to Tien, who looked as weary as the rest of them.
Would you say goodbye to Jem for us and give him all our regards?
Tien looked surprised.
You're leaving?
Magnus nodded. I really feel like we didn't have time to explore Shanghai in the way I'd have preferred. But I hope you won't take it as an insult if we New Yorkers head home straight from here. Magnus looked over and caught Alec's eye. I'd like to see my kid.
Of course not,
Tien smiled. A light had come back to his dark eyes that Alec hadn't even realized was missing before.
I'm going to go see Jingfeng. She'll be pretty happy to hear I'm not going to be spending time in DU anymore. Ragnar?
Ragnar turned to him, surprised.
As far as I know, you're the only person alive who has been stabbed by Hei Bai Wu Chang and survived. There might be some interesting side effects.
Excellent, said Ragnar mournfully. Something to look forward to in my coming years of shame and anonymity.
Tien turned to face the others.
Thank you all, by the way, for all that you have done, and for keeping my and Jinfang's secret.
And thank you, Tien, said Simon, reaching to shake the other boy's hand, for saving Isabel, for helping us.
There was a chorus of assent.
The cold peace won't last forever, said Alec. We'll keep working to make the clave see reason and bring it to an end.
I hope they will, said Tien. But I know you're not the only influential force within the clave these days.
He put a hand on Alec's shoulder.
You must understand how much of an inspiration you are, he said firmly. Your family, the two of you and your son, just by existing, by being so prominent in the clave, you are doing much. Your family, if the clave is to survive, that is their future. It must be.
No pressure, though, said Alec with a smile.
And you're an inspiration yourself. Don't forget it.
Tien inclined his head.
It's only a matter of time before there's a real fight for the soul of the clave. If we don't want the cohort's vision to become reality, we will have to be involved, to be loud, even if we would prefer not to be.
You're a good guy, Tien, Alec said. I'm glad we're on the same side.
He wasn't the loud one in his family. He was the quietest by a good margin. But Tien was right, and he was going to do some thinking. Ragnar and Magnus had started preparations on a portal home, though Ragnar seemed to be letting Magnus do most of the heavy lifting. His argument was that he was recovering from 3 strikes by a Svefenthorn, whereas Magnus was only recovering from 2.
You know who should open this portal? Clary, Magnus grumbled. Nothing that bad happened to her on this trip.
I'm not entirely comfortable with that girl's ability to open portals, Ragnar said, with a nervous glance in Clary's direction. She had Jace's arm around her and was laughing with Isabel. It was amazing how resilient people were, Magnus thought.
I find it theologically confusing.
That, said Magnus in breezy tones, is why I never think about the deeper meaning behind anything.
Ragnar's look told him that the other warlock knew very well that wasn't true.
So where are you headed? He said. Back to Idris? Tidy up your house for the first time in years?
Ragnar hesitated. Magnus rolled his eyes.
Don't tell me you're going to keep pretending you're dead. How well did that work last time?
The mistake I made, Ragnar said, was in trying to disappear completely. That just made me seem more suspicious.
He gave a paranoid look behind each of his shoulders.
There's going to be a lot of heat on me for a while. Xin Yan and I were not careful about being seen in the sunlit market. I'll be a person of interest to much of Downworld and possibly some shadow hunters as well. Not to mention, Xin Yan herself is still out there. Samael, too, eventually.
Magnus sighed.
Ragnar, do you know how many hits my reputation has taken over the years? I'm still working. Nobody's thrown me into the Silent City. Nobody's hauled me up in front of a fairy court.
That's different, said Ragnar. You weren't working for a prince of hell.
Ragnar, not long after you faked your death, I was being accused of running a cult for Asmodeus.
You did start that cult, Ragnar said, frowning. It was one of your less funny jokes, as I remember.
Then you'll be happy to know I was duly punished for it, Magnus said.
Ragnar paused in his magical machinations.
No, of course not, he sighed. Maybe you can take that kind of heat, Magnus. But I can't. More to the point, I don't wish to. I did bad things working for Samael. Actual bad things that I can't now take back. Just bringing Samael to DU should probably be a capital offense.
You were mind-controlled, said Magnus.
But I chose to take the third thorn. I chose that. I need time. To atone, I suppose. I've been dead for 3 years. I need to take some time to think of who Ragnar Fell will be when he comes back to life.
Magnus didn't say anything for a while as they finished the portal.
Will I still hear from you? Because if I don't, I'm going to assume Xin Yan has captured you again, and I will come for you.
Only you could make the promise of rescue sound like a threat, grumbled Ragnar. But yes, I expect you'll have frequent dealings with the new me.
Well, that's something, Magnus said. He paused. I didn't tell Katarina.
Nothing,
said Ragnar. Nothing. But that's not fair to her. I'll tell her when I see her next. It would mean a lot to her to know you're all right.
Ragnar looked surprised, but pleased.
Really?
Yes, said Magnus. You idiot. She cares more than almost anybody. There are so few of us, and...
He stopped. A terrible thought had occurred to him.
Oh, no, he said. You're not going to use that stupid alias again.
First of all, said Ragnar, I am not going to take naming advice from somebody who could have chosen any name in the world and went with Magnus Bane. Second, yes, I am going to use that name.
I wish you wouldn't, said Magnus.
It's only appropriate, Ragnar said with a wink. I am now, after all, but a shade of my former self.
Magnus let out a long groan. After saying goodbye to Ragnar and Tien, Alec and the rest of them stepped through the portal and walked out into a cool autumnal morning in New York. Unfortunately, they were standing in an alley near the Institute, which was redolent with the smell of garbage.
Ah, said Simon, home.
Magnus, said Jace, why didn't you just open the portal directly into the Institute?
One of the things that Alec had come to enjoy about raising a child with Magnus was that it was adorable when Magnus, the most self-assured, level-headed man he knew, looked uncertain and awkward. And having a child greatly increased the frequency with which Magnus looked uncertain and awkward. This was one of those times. Alec wanted to grab him and kiss him, but it did seem like a strange moment for it.
I didn't want to maybe wake up Max, Magnus said with a shrug.
Once they got inside, Max was quickly located, crawling happily around on the rug in Marise's study while being watched by Marise, Kadir, and, unexpectedly, Katarina. Rather than greeting any of them, Alec found himself discarding his usual self-possession and running to scoop Max up from the ground and hold him tightly. Max was pleased, but clearly puzzled by the intensity of Alec's affection. After a moment, he gave in and began laughing and wriggling happily. Magnus came over and stroked Max's head affectionately, looking a bit distracted. Jason and Isabel had gone to hug Marise. Simon and Clary were chattering to Kadir and Katarina. Holding Max, Alec leaned into Magnus, savoring the circle the three of them made, here, surrounded by their family and friends. He had risked his life and been thankful to get home safe many times before. This was different. This was painful and beautiful and terrible and perfect. Fairly soon, Jace, Clary, Simon, and Isabel excused themselves to go clean up. They were all streaked with dirt and grime. Alec knew he didn't look much better, but he didn't care. He bounced Max in his arms while Magnus dragged Katerina off for a conversation. Alec assumed he wanted to tell her about Ragnar. They had been close for centuries, and she would need to know the whole saga, starting with his not being dead and ending with wherever he was going now. For their part, Maryse and Kadir seemed happy, both to have watched Max and also to return the baby to his parents. Max, too, seemed sanguine enough. He bounced contentedly in Alec's arms.
"Wasn't too bad?" Alec said, smiling.
"No," said Maryse. "Not at all. Nothing I couldn't handle."
"I can't help but notice," Alec said, "that your arm is in a sling. Also," he added to Kadir, "that you have two black eyes."
Kadir and Maryse exchanged glances and then returned to their sunny smiles.
"Nothing to do with Max," Maryse said breezily. "Just a bit of an accident, hanging a picture on a high wall."
"Uh-huh," said Alec.
"So, definitely nothing to do with Max."
"The very idea is ridiculous," said Kadir solemnly.
"We had an excellent time watching Max," said Maryse firmly, "and we greatly look forward to doing it again."
"Again," agreed Max.
Alex chucked him under the chin. "Hey, kiddo," Clary said. She and Jace had returned, changed, and scrubbed. Her red hair shone. Alex noted that Jace was still carrying his spear from DU. Apparently, he'd grown fond of it. Clary ruffled Max's blue hair.
"Keeping out of trouble?"
"Boof,"
Max confided. He high-fived Jace.
"That's a fine spear, Jace," said Kadir. "Though I prefer a Naginata myself."
"Okay," said Jace. "Mom? Kadir? Clary and I were talking. And I think I'm willing to run the Institute, but only if I can do it with Clary. Both of us together."
Maryse seemed delighted. "I think that will work out fine." She looked over at Alec. "Did you help convince him?"
Alec shook his head.
"Nope. He decided on his own." "Have you told Isabel and Simon yet?" he added to Jace.
Jace and Clary exchanged a glance.
"We went to Isabel's room," Jace said cautiously, "but they seemed to be, busy."
"That's my sister," said Alec. "I didn't need to know that." He looked over at his mother, who was, or was, pretending to be deep in conversation with Kadir.
"At least you didn't have to hear it," said Clary.
The corner of Jace's lip twitched.
"I guess Simon has realized that rather than dwelling on life's uncertainties, you should spend quality time with people you love."
"Dear God," said Alec, "I am removing myself and my baby from this conversation."
He headed across the room to Magnus, still deep in discussion with Katerina. She looked stunned, but managed to smile as Alec approached them, carrying Max. Max held his chubby blue arms out to Magnus.
"Bah,"
he said.
"Oh, here," Alec said. "Take the little guy for a minute."
He prepared for the handoff. Magnus backed away, hands raised as though warding something off.
"No, you keep him for now. I'll just..."
"What?" said Alec. "What's wrong?" Magnus looked around, hectically.
I've been very monstery recently. I'm still a little rattled from that. I don't want to, you know, drop him or anything."
"Magnus," Alec said, "you aren't monstery. You're Magnus. Take your kid."
"Excuse us, Alec," said Katerina, and caught hold of Magnus's hand. "I need to borrow your boyfriend for a moment."
Katerina thrust Magnus into a chair in the hallway. He was still slightly dizzy. She had advanced on him and dragged him away from Alec and Max with startling force. Sometimes he forgot how strong she was. She stared at him intensely.
"Don't do this," she said.
"What?"
"Don't do this self-loathing, wah-wah, I'm a monster thing. It's unbecoming."
Magnus hesitated.
You didn't see Xin Yun. I got very close to becoming a monster. It's a complete fluke that I was saved.
Katerina looked at him skeptically. I thought it was a very clever plan, executed by your boyfriend.
Well, yes, but it was a guess on his part. He didn't know it would work. I'm still not sure why it did work.
And so suddenly, after hundreds of years, you've decided that what? You're a danger to the people you love? Because you're a Vorlach, and Vorlachs have demon parents? You've gone through this before, you know, and come out the other side. You don't need me to give you the speech about how we're defined by what we do, not what we are. I've heard you give that speech yourself.
Katerina's look was compassionate, but Magnus could feel her aggravation in the set of her shoulders. They really had known each other a very long time.
It's different now, Magnus said.
He paused.
Do you remember the Shanghai Club in 1910?
Katerina nodded slowly.
It was just after Ephraim passed away.
I asked you if raising him had been worth it, Magnus said. You gave so much, and he lived a good life, but then he died anyway.
Ah, said Katerina with a small smile. That's why it's different now.
Magnus nodded sheepishly.
Magnus, you are surrounded by people who love you. I didn't let Ephraim go until I made sure he too was surrounded with love. He's living to a ripe old age, dying in his bed surrounded by his family. I was so sad when he died, but it was also a victory. I had saved that boy. I had raised him into a man. He had lived, had loved others. He had exactly what I wanted him to have.
But Max, began Magnus, and Katerina waved her hands.
Magnus, I hate to sound like Ragnar, but you are an idiot sometimes. I am telling you that you are doing good, that you are doing the right things. Your loved ones, your family, will be there to save you when you need saving, and they will be there to help save Max if he needs saving. You have to trust in that.
She gave him a wry smile.
You are literally the person who taught me that.
Magnus shook his head, overwhelmed.
You're right. It's just hard to remember sometimes. It feels so different now with Max. My responsibility to him is so huge, so much bigger than any responsibility I've felt before.
Yep, said Katerina, folding her arms. We call that being a parent.
Magnus held up his hands in surrender.
Okay, he said. Okay, you win. And since you're my oldest friend, or one of them...
You're going to ask me for a favor, aren't you?
Said Katerina in a resigned tone. Magnus reached into his torn and tattered jacket and drew out the Book of the White.
Bring this to the spiral labyrinth for me, will you? He said. I think I'm done looking after it for now.
It was always strange for Alec to leave the Institute, to say goodbye to his mother and Isabel and Jace and return home. The Institute had been his home for so many years, and while he'd settled into Magnus's apartment being their apartment, there was still always a brief moment as they departed when Alec felt like something was off. Back at home, Magnus called the Mansion Hotel in Shanghai and arranged to have all their things placed into storage, from which he planned to teleport them home when the hotel staff weren't looking. Alec played with Max, who crawled happily around the living room, enjoying the quiet of being home. Presently, Magnus returned and scooped up Max, who protested briefly before giving up, breaking into a beaming smile and immediately beginning to chew on one of Magnus's buttons.
They're pretty, aren't they? Magnus said.
You know, said Alec,
I always got that our job was saving the world, but it's way more terrifying now that Max is here.
Excuse me, said Magnus. Maybe your job is saving the world. My job is harder to summarize. But a significant portion is just about looking good.
Oh, said Alec. So when the world needs saving, you're not going to show up and save it.
Sure, that sounds like the Magnus I know.
Hey, Max, he added, and Max briefly paused in his intent chewing to look over at Alec. Is that your Bob Hawk? Can you say Bob Hawk?
He doesn't say Bob Hawk yet, Magnus said in a whisper. Don't pressure him.
It's weird, said Alec. It's a weird life. But it's the life we're made for, I guess. And the life we choose.
Papa!
Max yelled loudly, waving an arm. Behind him, one of the curtains in the window burst into flame. Alec sighed, grabbed a couch cushion, and went to beat the fire out.
Our other job, said Magnus, is to keep Max from burning down this whole building until he's old enough to control his magic.
Alec smiled. After Samael, that seems almost possible, said Max.
Bob Hawk?
Alec said again.
Max frowned in concentration and then began chewing on the button again. Much, much later, when all was dark and quiet in the apartment and they were all back in their own beds, Magnus awoke from fitful dreams. Very carefully, he freed himself from the grasp of Alec's arm, crept out of bed, threw on a sweater over his silk pajamas, and made his way across the hall and into the other bedroom. Almost immediately, he saw two very blue eyes peering at him over the edge of the crib. The lurking eyes reminded Magnus of a time he'd seen a hippo lying in wait with its eyes just above the waterline. Magnus strolled toward the crib. Hey there, you, he whispered. I see someone who shouldn't be up.
There was a growing twinkle in the blue eyes, as though Max had been caught with his hand in the cookie jar, but was hoping to find a co-conspirator to cut in on his illicit cookie deals. When Magnus approached, Max lifted his arms in silent demand to be scooped up.
Who's a wicked rule-breaking warlock? Said Magnus, complying with the request. Who's my baby?
Max squealed in delight. Magnus lifted his son up high. Then he tossed Max into the air in a shower of iridescent blue sparks and watched him laugh, perfectly happy, perfectly trusting that when he came down, his father would catch him. The sound of song ruffled the calm of Alec's slumbers. He could have easily let himself roll over in their silk sheets and fall back into the luxurious warmth of sleep, but instead, he pulled himself to the surface of awareness. He was still drowsy, but the song was sweet, and it made him want to see. When he slid open the door and peered into Max's room, he did. Magnus was dressed for comfort at home. In fact, he was wearing one of Alec's sweaters, the thick, worn fabric slipping to one side on his narrower shoulders. As with most things, Magnus made it look good. Nina Bobo, Nini Bobo, he was singing in his deep, beautiful voice, an Indonesian lullaby, much older than Magnus himself. He rocked their child in his arms. Max was waving his hands as though to conduct the song or to catch the firefly, bright and cobalt blue sparks of magic floating around the room. Magnus was smiling down at Max, a small, tender, an impossibly sweet smile, even as he sang. Alec meant to let them be and return to bed, but Magnus paused in his song and tossed Alec a glance as though he knew he'd been watching. Alec leaned in the doorway of the bedroom, resting his hand over his head against the doorframe.
Is that your Bob Hawk?
He said to Max. After some consideration, Max said,
Bob Hawk!
The look Magnus gave Alec was golden as a coin, as Nephilim wedding cloth, as the morning light through the windows of home. Epilogue.
In a place beyond place, the princes of hell gathered. A request had come, making the veils of the worlds reverberate with the sound of their brother's voice. That it was a request and not a command was itself surprising. Some came out of loyalty, some out of curiosity. Some came because if the others were coming, they were certainly coming as well. "I know we don't talk much," Samael began. They settled down and gave him their attention. They were a motley sort of crew, he had to admit. From Belial, appearing as he most often did as a beautiful pale-haired man, to Leviathan, who was more of a dark green serpent with sleek scales and arms that could be charitably described as tentacle adjacent. "I know we mostly go our own ways," Samael went on. "We only see one another to fight, over territory, over power. That's how it's been, since the beginning." That was how it was at present as well. Belphegor and Belial had ignored each other completely since they arrived, each refusing to acknowledge the other's existence. Leviathan and Mammon had decided to sit in the same chair, each arguing that it was the only cosmically large chair present, and as the most sizable of the princes, he deserved it more. Samael considered explaining to them that the chair was only a metaphysical construct, and there could just as easily be two chairs as one, since they were in a place beyond place and all that. But he didn't like to get involved. Asmodeus, obviously the strongest of them by most measures, still maintained his loyalty to Samael. Luckily for Samael. When he bowed his head in acknowledgement of Samael's superiority, the others took note, and Samael didn't think he would have too much trouble with them.
"If that's the way it's always been, then that's the way it's supposed to be," said Astaroth.
There was nodding from the others.
"Recently," Samael said, "as some of you surely know, the love of my life, the great mother of demons, Lilith, was killed by humans on Earth. It has destroyed me," he went on sharply. "I grieve with a grief to make stars collapse."
Azazel rolled his eyes.
"I see that, Azazel," Samael snapped. "None of you perhaps understand, as you believe love is incompatible with the goals of the demonic realms, but I am here to tell you that you are wrong," he said. "Lilith was the greatest of my strength," he said, choking up a little. "And only now that she is gone do I feel a part missing from me."
There was a silence. Belial said,
"Samael, have you brought us all here, disturbing our activities across the entire universe in order to tell us that love is real?"
"No," said Samael. "Well, okay. Love is real. So if you're capable of taking any insight from that, there it is. But no, I have a more concrete reason for gathering you. Recently," he went on, "I had a series of strange encounters with humans, with warlocks and Nephilim in the broken courts of the realm of Diyu."
"Diyu?" rumbled Mammon. "Yan Luo's old place? We had some parties there."
"Yes," said Samael. "And you should see the state it's in now. Not good."
He gave them a significant look. "But that's important to my point. All my plans there came to ruin."
"You have brought us here," said Belial, his diction as elegant as always, "to tell us that love is real and that you are terrible at your job."
Samael ignored this.
"I failed not because I lacked power, and not because the realm of Diyu was unable to serve me. I failed because I did not account for the power that a group can have, working together and having each other's back."
The other princes of hell exchanged puzzled glances.
I really found it quite inspiring, Samael said. And so I come to you with a proposal, dear brothers. Too long have we gone it alone. If we are ever to truly achieve our larger goals, we must recognize that we are more alike than we are different. We must put aside our old grievances, forget them, and work together.
Asmodeus looked astonished.
You mean...
Yes, said Samael. I want to talk about Lucifer.
In Dreams Begin, a bonus story featuring Tessa and Jem. Magnus Bane was scheming. To an untrained observer, the High Warlock of Brooklyn wouldn't look like he was doing much of anything at all. For one thing, he was wearing purple silk pajamas. For another thing, he was in bed, leaning back against a pile of pillows with a spellbook open in his lap. Beside him, Alec Lightwood was stretched out on his side, deeply asleep. Earlier that day, Alec had taken their son Max to the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. This had been at Magnus's request. He wanted Max to have ample opportunity to tire himself out before bedtime. It worked almost too well. Max had made fast friends with a werewolf toddler named Eliza, and the two of them tore around the gardens blissfully for about 3 hours straight, Max crawling while Eliza ran, albeit unsteadily. Eliza's mother had been quite surprised the first time Max levitated. Luckily, he was glamoured, so only she and Alec noticed. Though not possessed of much vocabulary, Eliza clearly wanted Max to levitate her as well. Fortunately, Max did not yet have that sort of skill. Alec and Max returned home happy, covered in mud, and best of all, exhausted. Magnus really wanted them all to sleep through the night. Magnus shifted position and peered across the room at the mantel clock atop the dresser, a hideous thing covered in petai that Ragnar had given him years ago. The room was lit only by a candle that burned with a blue flame on the table beside him, but he could make out the numbers. It was 1:45 a.m. Surely that was late enough. Surely even the shadow hunters and downworlders of the West Coast would be turning in. He'd given Katerina and Jem and Tessa a heads up, after all. And as for the Blackthorns and Emma Carstairs, they were kids. And not even babies with their bizarre and erratic relationship to sleep. Surely they would be asleep by now, worn out from running around on the beach or whatever it was that the residents of the Los Angeles Institute did all day. Yes, it was time. Snuggling a little farther under the blanket, Magnus looked fondly over at Alec's sleeping form, his black hair like spilled ink across the ivory pillowcase. He closed his book and set it on the bedside table. He mentally reached within, feeling about for a particular pocket of magic folded away deep inside, a self-contained bubble. It had been 2 weeks since he'd been freed from the influence of the Sveffenthorn, and while the markings on his skin had faded, his teeth had shrunk back to their normal size, and the overcharged magic of the artifact had left his system, this one reserve of magical energy had lingered. At first, Magnus had considered hanging on to it as a sort of insurance policy. A little extra magic went a long way, especially when the magic was this potent. And Magnus was quite certain that he and Alec and their friends would have plenty more dangers to face in the years to come. That was their job, after all. But clinging to the magic out of fear of imagined dangers didn't feel good. It felt like letting demons have a small victory over him, playing right into their scaly, demonic hands. No, instead he had resolved to use the power in a decidedly un-demon-sanctioned manner.
to create joy. Magnus shut his eyes. Oniromancy, the study and practice of dream magic, had never been one of his specialties. But with the added kernel of power from the Svefenthorn, he felt quite confident that he could pull off this one feat, even as complex as it was. The trickiest part, it seemed to him, was holding himself in that drowsy state between waking and sleeping, while maintaining enough awareness to cast the spell. He lay back against the pillows, letting his eyelids flutter shut for just a moment. When Magnus opened his eyes again, he was standing in the middle of Blackfriars Bridge, the panorama of London spread out around him in all directions. He took a deep breath of river-tasting air. The sky was a dark violet, the sun only just beginning to rise. There was no traffic, which was a distinct advantage of throwing a party on a dream bridge rather than on the real thing. There was a warm breeze in the air, and the Thames danced beneath it, silvery in the dawn light. Had he ever noticed wind in a dream before? Magnus wasn't sure. He admired the view from the bridge. It seemed just about right, though he hadn't been here for a couple of decades. Perhaps some ugly new construction had taken place since then, but who would fault him for omitting that? Magnus! He turned and saw two figures hurrying toward him. It was Tessa and Jem, both in what Magnus assumed was their pajamas. Tessa's were gray, with white rabbits on them. Jem's were dark green and navy blue plaid. They were barefoot, but that wouldn't matter on a dream bridge. He started to smile as they got closer, and he could see they were both giddy and laughing, a hint of disbelief on their faces. Tessa threw her arms around him, knocking him off balance. He marveled at how solid and real she felt. "It's working," she said in wonder. A magical discipline unexplored is always worth exploring, Magnus said, stepping back. I may be late to the game with Oniromancy, but I plan to make up for my tardiness all at once right now. Is that what you're planning to wear to your wedding?
It's not traditional, but neither was the yellow cotton shift dress I wore for the courthouse wedding. And I do love bunnies, said Tessa. I'm all right with it, if Jem is.
I would marry you if you were wearing a barrel, said Jem.
Oh, but why would I be wearing a barrel? Said Tessa. They were both grinning at each other stupidly.
Magnus decided something needed to be done. He wasn't sure how long his magic would hold out. I won't have it, he said. If I'm to throw you a dream wedding, you must be properly dressed for the occasion. It's in my contract. I do hope you read the fine print. He snapped his fingers, and Jem's pajamas were replaced by an exquisitely cut black suit. Magnus aimed for something that suggested the style of the Shadowhunter gear Jem had worn long ago in the first years he knew Tessa. Wedding runes were intricately embroidered on the lapels in gold thread. As Jem marveled at the excellent fit, Magnus turned his attention to Tessa.
I know, he said, a wedding dress is a highly personal choice. But as our other guests will be arriving momentarily, and time is of the essence, I'm going to take a stab at it.
You have my express permission, Tessa said.
Magnus snapped his fingers again. And then Tessa was wearing a beautiful sleeveless gown of pale silver with a full skirt that reminded Magnus of the first time he'd met her at a vampire ball. A couple more flicks of his fingers, and her hair rearranged itself beautifully into an updo with a few tendrils loose around her face. One more gesture, and Tessa's familiar jade pendant appeared around her neck, as did the pearl bracelet she always wore, a gift from Will on their 30th anniversary. Tessa looked startled, reaching up to touch her hair, then brushing her hands over her gown. How do I look? Jem looked very young again as he gazed at her, his dark eyes full of emotion.
Ni han piao liang, he whispered. You are very beautiful.
Magnus turned away to give them a moment and felt familiar arms close around him. Alec kissed Magnus on his forehead. Being slightly shorter than Magnus, he had to pull Magnus down a bit to do it, which Magnus didn't mind at all, and muttered, "You're a sentimental bastard, aren't you?" in his ear. But he was grinning all over his face as he turned to greet Tessa and Jem, congratulating them. They both looked delighted to see him.
"So let me get this straight," Alec said. "You, me, Tessa, and Jem will all remember this with perfect recall. For the other guests, they'll remember it at first, but then it will fade away the way dreams do?"
"That is correct. They won't recall it the way we will, but their souls will be present and glad for it."
"Well, mostly glad for it," Magnus said. "What do you mean, mostly?"
Jem said nervously.
"I mean that I'm not sure how church will feel about the whole thing."
"Church!"
Alec and Jem exclaimed at the same time, and turned to see the grumpy Persian cat sauntering toward them down the center of the bridge. Tessa laughed.
"Well, he does sleep 20 hours a day. I suppose we shouldn't be surprised."
"I took the liberty of adding him to the guest list you gave me," Magnus said. "I'm trying to get on his good side."
"Why?" Alec asked, incredulous. "He's a cat."
"So he won't hate me forever when I do this."
Magnus snapped his fingers, and a silver bow in the same fabric as Tessa's dress appeared around Church's neck. Church's eyes widened for a moment. Then he sat down and, after a moment, became very focused on cleaning his front paw.
"Now," Magnus said, "I simply must get this bridge decorated."
"It's decorated perfectly,"
said a voice from behind him. Turning, he saw Clary, who was holding Max. Behind her was Jace, followed by Isabel and Simon, who were leaning together, whispering conspiratorially. Jocelyn and Luke were there, looking slightly unkempt, and Magnus remembered that they were in the process of remodeling a barn at Luke's farm so Jocelyn could expand her painting studio. Ragnar and Katerina had also appeared, as well as a whole gaggle of kids. The Blackthorn clan, Julian and Helen, Tiberius and Livia, Drusilla and Octavian. Emma Carstairs was with them, though she broke away from the group immediately, running to hug Clary. They were the same height now, Magnus noticed with amusement. Max had escaped from Clary and was riding on Alec's shoulders now, babbling a story to Helen Blackthorne and her wife, Aileen. They looked very amused, though it was unlikely they understood even a quarter of what he said. Mariz and Kadir were there, too, already deep in conversation with Jocelyn and Luke. Kadir hadn't been on the guest list Jem and Tessa had given Magnus because they didn't really know him, but Magnus had added him as Maurice's plus one. It never hurt to butter up your boyfriend's mother, especially when she was willing to babysit for days at a time. A couple of silent brothers had appeared. Enoch, Shadrach. Magnus was slightly embarrassed to admit that they all looked alike to him, now that Jem was no longer counted among their number as Brother Zachariah. Magnus hadn't known if the Grigori would be able to attend, since they didn't normally sleep. One of them, Enoch, inclined his hooded head slightly at Magnus, acknowledging this mad thing he was doing as worthwhile. At least, that was how Magnus chose to interpret the gesture. Octavian was climbing Jace like a jungle gym. Clary was talking with Julian and Emma, while Tiberius stood near his older brother, looking around at London with fierce curiosity in his gray eyes. Livia and Drusilla were perched on the railing of the bridge, Livia chatting animatedly with Simon and Isabel, Drusilla looking around shyly. Katerina went to lean beside her, asking her a question. Magnus looked at the motley assortment of clothing on the assembled group. Mostly casual, though there were more pajamas as well. Magnus made two sweeping gestures
and all at once everyone was looking very sharp in formal attire. Even better, they barely seemed to notice the change. Magnus was impressed. Oh, Nyromancy, who knew? A hand gripped his arm. It was Tessa, who looked close to tears.
Magnus, I can't believe you're doing this for us.
She trailed off, at a loss for words. Magnus regarded her fondly. Tessa, most people's idea of a dream wedding is not a literal dream wedding. But since yours is, I am happy to oblige. Shall we get this show on the road? Jem and Tessa took their places on either side of Magnus, and the guests gathered round. The sun had climbed well above the horizon, casting rays of warm light between the long shadows of the wedding guests. Dear friends, Magnus said to Jem and Tessa, we are honored to share this moment with you, and I am doubly honored to be given the chance to speak. Several hundred years ago, I got very drunk, and woke up an ordained minister. Today, I have decided that doing so was a wise choice after all. Jocelyn snorted, then looked embarrassed. Luke grinned at her. Joking aside, it is impossible to stand here with you all and not feel that there is some greater plan at work, some greater force that has brought these two souls across more than a century to be joined as one. Clary's eyes were glistening. Jace reached into his pocket and offered her what looked like a handkerchief, but was more likely a soft cloth for polishing blades. She gave a wry smile of recognition and sniffled into it. I debated which customs to follow in officiating this wedding, Magnus went on. Whether to conduct a shadow hunter ceremony or a warlock ceremony or even a mundane ceremony. For many worlds have been united in the two of you. But none of these traditions seemed quite appropriate on their own. So I've attempted to tailor a ceremony that will honor your unique paths. Magnus nodded to Jem, who reached into his pocket and produced a gold ring. Jem had requested a single word etched around the outside of it. Mizpah. It has been said, said Magnus, that when two people are at one in their inmost hearts, they shatter even the strength of iron or bronze. Teresa Gray, are you at one with James Carstairs in your inmost heart? Tessa's eyes were wide, her face serious as she gazed at Jem.
I am, she said, offering her hand to him.
He slid the ring onto her finger. Then Magnus nodded at Tessa, who produced another ring, this one from thin air. Magnus had to suppress the grin that threatened to break his calm, officiant expression. It delighted him that Tessa was engaging in a small amount of oniromancy herself, and Jem looked as pleased by it as Magnus felt. This ring was the exact match of the first, and he knew what it said as well. May the angel watch between me and thee when we are absent from one another. James Carstairs, Ke Tianming, are you at one with Teresa Gray in your inmost heart?
I am, Jem said, delight visible in his dark eyes.
Tessa put the ring on him, and they stood for a moment, holding hands and smiling at each other like they couldn't quite believe this was happening. For I am persuaded, said Magnus, and Jem and Tessa both looked up at him, recognizing a piece of the old Shadowhunter wedding ceremony, though he had altered the wording, that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor demons, nor principalities, nor powers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall be able to separate these two. He stretched out his arms. Therefore, I am overjoyed to declare this marriage consecrated here in the presence of your friends and family. Tessa Gray
and Jem Carstairs, you are married. And the world is better for it. You may kiss each other, not that you really need my permission. The assembled crowd cheered as Jem and Tessa kissed, a kiss that had been long delayed. The kiss continued, and Magnus slowly backed away, joining the cheering audience. "Let's give them a moment," he said, and happy chatter swelled around him. Magnus noted that Alec was looking very foxy in his Armani suit, laughing with Marie's. Ragnar and Katerina were cackling over something, glad to be reunited now that Ragnar didn't have to pretend to be dead, or at least didn't have to pretend with them. Clary had her arm draped over Emma's shoulders, and Jace was arguing with Simon about how to properly tie a necktie. Tiberius and Drusilla were watching this argument as though it were a tennis match. Julian had lifted Octavian up so he could look down at the river flowing by beneath. Isabel was joking with Livia, who was giving Max a piggyback ride. It was a miraculously good wedding. Here they were, his friends. They'd literally gone into hell twice with him now. He found himself reflecting on how much had changed. At first, his life had felt like Magnus against the world. Then, for years and years, it had been Magnus, Katerina, and Ragnar against the world. Now his community was a much larger group, one that had spread wide enough that instead of Magnus and his friends against the world, it felt like Magnus and his friends a part of the world. Probably the best part of the world. It was a good feeling. "Look!" a girl's voice cried. It was Drusilla, pointing up into the sky, eyes wide with wonder. There was a collective gasp as the crowd saw what she had spotted. Two figures flew overhead, riding a translucent white stallion with two gold hooves and two silver. One of them was a blonde boy in ragged clothes who looked down at the blackthorns and waved. The figure in front of him was harder to make out, a gentry fairy in clothes just as ragged, only he was as translucent as the horse. The blonde boy must be Mark Blackthorne, Magnus marveled. He'd invited the whole family, not knowing whether those who rode with the Wild Hunt could be summoned by dream magic. He had his answer, but it came with another mystery. Who was this companion, so close to Mark that they would appear together in a dream? The riders made a circle overhead, while the Blackthorns shouted and waved, and Mark waved back, smiling an odd smile down at them. Then they faded away into the morning air. Magnus saw with relief that Jace, Clary, Simon, Isabel, and Alec had all moved in around the Blackthorn kids, giving them an opportunity to talk about what they had just seen. Their stolen brother, visiting so briefly. He glanced over and saw Tessa and Jem still standing by the railing. There was a shimmer beside them, at the edge of the bridge, and the hair on the back of Magnus's neck rose. He knew Will Herondale had never haunted the mortal world, because he had lived and died happily and had no unfinished business among the living. While Magnus didn't subscribe to any specific set of beliefs about reincarnation or an afterlife, he had always had a strong sense that Will was waiting on the other bank of a dark river, be it Lethe or some other border between the living and the dead. He was there among the green grass, the sky above as dark a blue as his eyes, waiting patiently for Jem and Tessa to join him, that he might lead them by the hand to whatever wonders lay beyond the veil. The philosophers of ancient Greece had believed dreams and sleep to be the twin of death, Morpheus and Hades standing side by side, and here in that space, Magnus would not have been surprised if Will stretched out his hand to those he had loved best in life, to Jem and Tessa. He was, after all, a Herondale, and very stubborn. Alec sidled up to Magnus, leaving the Blackthorns in the capable hands of his siblings and their partners. The kids seemed to have taken Mark's appearance as a sort of wedding favor created especially for them.
Alec twined an arm around Magnus's waist and pulled him close, kissing him on the temple. "It was very kind of you to use the last of your Svefenthorn magic on this," he said. Magnus leaned into Alec.
"Well, it wasn't enough magic to send us to the moon or get us into the front row at the Alexander McQueen runway, so I figured next best thing."
Alec smiled at him pointedly. "Actually, I happen to know that you did it because you are an incredibly kind person. And that is one of the many things I love about you."
"Oh, dear," Magnus said, turning to face him. "You know all my secrets."
Then they were kissing. And kissing, in a magical dream, turned out to be just as perfect as kissing in the waking world.
The Eldest Curses, Book 2, The Lost Book of the White, was written by Cassandra Clare and Wesley Chu, and read by B.D. Wong. The recording engineers were Chris Gardner, Mark De La Fuente, and Brianna Villarreal with Dave and Dave Recording Studios. Editing, mix, and post-production by Steven Strassman. The associate producer was Claire Tadakoro. The Lost Book of the White was produced and directed by Randy Dolnick. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Eldest Curses, Book 2, The Lost Book of the White, is available in print from Margaret K. McElderry Books. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Eldest Curses, Book 1, The Red Scrolls of Magic, by Cassandra Clare and Wesley Chu, read by B.D. Wong.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.